Thank you. I want to invite folks who are patiently standing in the back. If you want to sit up here, there's room for folks and on the floor. whatever is most comfortable for folks, but we are comfortable being surrounded by people. So it's a sign that people are listening. One of the things that we love on our travels is coming to sanctuaries like this because they represent so many things. Sanctuaries of dissent, and also to be working with bookstores like Women and Children First, who are also sanctuaries, a place that preserves independent voices, independent thinking. And this, as we know, is, independent bookstores are an endangered species. So you are so lucky. And to hear that this is one of the last remaining feminist bookstores in the country, that's bittersweet, obviously, but wonderful to be in the presence of a store that has been such an important part of this community for so long. So 20 years ago, Amy came home, and as she often does, she came to tell us about a new project that she had. We'd heard about a lot of her projects, and we were always very excited, but as her family, we had to give her, unvarnished feedback. So Amy, at that time, was the news director at WBAI in New York City, one of the five flagship Pacifica radio stations. And she was on the news, broadcasting the news every morning. But now this was something different. She said that Pacifica was launching an election show. It was 1996. This was the re-election campaign of Bill Clinton. He was running against Bob Dole in that election, as I recall. So this was going to be something new. It was going to be covering the election, using the election as a vehicle to travel the country and bring not voices from the corporate suites, but voices from the streets. Your voices. And in these travels, it would be to talk to the real change makers in the country, not the politicians and the pundits and the titans of industry, but the movements, the change makers in all these communities. Well, this was going to be an experiment. It was going to last 8 months. They'd start it in February, and they'd wrap up, a few days after the election. And it was going to be called Democracy Now, to which I, as her brother, just had to let her know, Democracy Now? What is that? You're going to call a radio show Democracy Now? Nobody's going to listen to that. And so she said, well, what do you think I should call it? And I'm like, it has to be stealth. You just have to fly under the radar, lure them in something like, Conversations with Amy. Or the election show, or, just plain vanilla. That's the way you do it. Well, we learned then what you all have learned since, which is Amy doesn't really follow conventional wisdom, even when it comes to her family. And so, fortunately for all of us, she did not take my bad advice, and Democracy Now! Went on the air, and that 8-month experiment, as you all know, has turned into 20 years. What? And gone from an original 9 stations to now over 1,400 radio and TV and internet, where millions tune in every day. And that has been the, that's how that ball got rolling way back when. Well, oddly enough, some of the success of democracy now, we really have to thank the corporate media because of the void that was left by the work that they were doing. That void was where our corporate media has become, instead of being challenging those in power, it has been a megaphone for those in power. The consequences of that have been terrible. We know that, for example, during the Iraq War, where you had a government and the Bush administration putting out propaganda and lies, and the media, rather than challenge it, was a megaphone and a conveyor belt for the lies. And those lies cost lives. And here we are all these years later. It seems a lifetime ago we went into Iraq. We are still there. We are still talking about sending even more troops to that same place because of a war that, had the media been doing its job, would not probably have ever happened. So, you know, we talk in our books about the disinformation two-step, this little dance that is done by the those in power and the media. And in the case of the Iraq War, there was the famous moment, you know, how do you launch a war based on lies? Well, you can't just stand on the White House steps and shout these things out. No, you need a lot of help. So Dick Cheney and the White House puts out this idea that the smoking gun will be a mushroom cloud. That was the phrase that they canned. It was really catchy. And of course, they had good help in this kind of catchy marketing stuff. The chief of staff at the time was a guy named Andrew Card. He was the head lobbyist for General Motors. And as he said, when you know, in hindsight, and they said, why was it in September that you launched it? And he said, well, everybody knows you don't roll out a new product in August. And so it was in the beginning of August 2003 that Cheney puts out this idea and leaks it to the national security correspondent of the New York Times at that time, Judith Miller, who was in deep with the White House. And so Cheney goes on the Sunday talk shows to say, the smoking gun will be a mushroom cloud. And then he says the all-important phrase, don't take it from me, take it from the New York Times, where they had put that very phrase in the headlines that morning. That's the disinformation two-step, where fiction and reality get so tightly braided, it's impossible to tease them apart. So onto this scene, we now fast forward to 2015, where somebody who can, in any other era, in any other time, might only be described as a cartoon character, a reality TV star, enters the stage. But actually, he understood our media better than the media understood our media. His mix of lies and theatrics, misogyny, xenophobia, and all this kind of bellicose blunder that we were becoming accustomed to was irresistible for what we call our news establishment. How much did they give him? Well, a study was done placing a fair market value on the free media that Trump got in the primary through the general election season. Anybody want to guess what the value of the free media that he was given, all the airtime that he didn't pay a dime for? I'm hearing a billion, a million, $5 billion was the value of what of the free airtime he was given. It was more than Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, Marco Rubio, Cruz, and Paul Ryan put together. So this juggernaut comes rolling through our living rooms, our radio, our airwaves, and that's how this all unfolds. And now he's president. So, you know, for a journalist, courage is not something that happens in hindsight. Courage is telling the truth, speaking inconvenient truths, when it matters. It's not a comfortable place to be. And I can tell you that as Amy's brother, we've been getting these calls home from police stations, from army barracks in Indonesia, where she was held after trying to get into the country, where she had survived a massacre in East Timor in 1991 with her colleague Alan Nairn, who had his skull fractured by soldiers wielding U.S.-made M16s, just simply bringing the voices back. In our book, our newest book here, there's a whole section called An Independent Reporter's Rap Sheet. And that's the numerous times Amy has been arrested, assaulted, harassed, and detained just for trying to tell the news that no one else is telling. Democracy Now has become the beating heart of a movement that spans the globe. It is the place that you go to every day to know that you are not crazy and you are not alone. So, here is to at least 20 more years of Democracy Now! And the best, most courageous, most dedicated journalist in our country, my sister, Amy.
My God, what an absolute thrill to be here, to be back in Chicago. And I also want to say, if a few more people want to come forward, you could sit a little here, you can sit a little over here on the ground if anyone wants to sit on the floor. What's that? Yes, you want to sit on the altar, good, okay. But really, people could sit right here and here, and there's room for plenty of people. So I want to say thank you so much to the church and to Pastor Fred for opening up this church to allow this assembly of people. And I want to thank Women and Children First, a wonderful independent bookstore here in Chicago. What a pleasure it is to work with them again. Also, we are handing out daily digests, and if you want to sign up, you can get our news alerts, our headlines every day. See, there are a few more. These are even like chairs here. And I hope that you'll fill them out. If you are text savvy, you can sign up by just texting the word Democracy Now, one word, no space, to 66866. And you'll be able to sign up for our news headlines, for our news segments that we do, and any news alerts. Help yourself. Now, see, a whole area opened up. And I'd love people in the back to come forward if you'd like to. It makes me tired just to look at you and think about you standing for the whole talk. But feel free. Feel free. You can always come in and out as I'm speaking.
Thank you very much.
Okay, sure. It's such an honor to be here as we zigzag across the country. Tomorrow we'll be in, Kalamazoo in the morning, in the afternoon Lansing, and later the afternoon we'll be in Grand Rapids. Then we head to Philadelphia the next day after doing the show in New York in the morning, and I reunite with my dear Juan Gonzalez for our broadcast on Monday morning. And then on Tuesday night in New York, Wednesday, we fly to Seattle, to Seattle Town Hall. You can let people know. DemocracyNow.org shows you my entire life. It shows you everywhere I'll be, all the time. and things we think about all day and night. On Thursday, back in New York, broadcasting, and on Friday we'll be doing a big event at the New School in New York, and then it's on to Oregon on Saturday, and a week spin through California, which I'm really looking forward to. But we started in Denver a few weeks ago. Oh, and I also want to give a total shout out. Can you hand me that yellow piece of paper? This is going to be very DIY, do it yourself. Thank you very much. To thank the radio and television stations that run Democracy Now, like WZRD 88.3 FM every morning, 8 o'clock, if you want to tune in. I hope everyone has these flyers. If not, come up afterwards and we'll give you some. All the radio stations like WCPT and CPY and Free Speech TV and Link TV, WYCC PBS in Chicago, and Pan TV every morning at 7 o'clock, Channel 19 in Chicago. As well, University of St. Francis Television, and others. You can always ask Chicago Public Radio and Chicago Public Television to run Democracy Now! As David said, we began on 9 stations, community radio stations, in 1996. Today, 21 years later, we're broadcasting on over 1,400 community radio stations, college stations, NPR stations, Pacifica stations, public access TV stations, and PBS stations increasingly all over the country. A station a week is picking us up. We broadcast throughout the United States and the world, and our headlines are translated into Spanish. If you want to learn Spanish or you want to learn English, compare our headlines every day in both languages. You know, it's so much more interesting than, you know, the basics in Spanish or English when you're learning, you know, Jack and Jill Run Down the Hill. This is the headlines of the day in both languages, and they're in audio form in Spanish, so you can really listen. Stations run the headlines in Spanish every day throughout Latin America, the United States, Spain, Europe, around the world as well. We are committed to building independent media in the United States and around the world. You know, we began originally on radio, on Pacifica Radio, and now we're an independent nonprofit. But we began on the Pacifica Radio Network, which was founded in 1949 in Berkeley, California, by a man named Lou Hill, who was a war resister, who came out of the detention camps and said, there's got to be a media outlet that's not run by corporations that profit from war, but run by journalists and artists. And that's how Pacifica was formed. Not run by corporations, as George Gerbner, the former dean of the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania, would say, not run by corporations that have nothing to tell and everything to sell, that are raising our children today. And so KPFA went on the air in 1949. KPFK went on the air in 1959 in Los Angeles. My station, WBAI in New York, 1960. In the first year of operation of WBAI, they were running a debate between Malcolm X and James Baldwin over the effectiveness of nonviolent civil disobedience, the lunch counter sit-ins. WPFW in Washington went on the air 40 years ago in 1977. We just did a big fundraiser for them after the People's Climate March on April 29th. We broadcast for 5 hours in the boiling heat. How many of you were in Washington? And how many of you went out in Chicago for that day? Well, it was the hottest April 29th in Washington, D.C. in history. 150,000 to 200,000 people, the organizers estimated, came out. We did a 5-hour broadcast, checkdemocracynow.org. It is fantastic, the breadth, the array of voices from every continent. And they didn't have to come to Washington because there were protests on every continent. And compare that to the week before, the March for Science in Washington. That was freezing cold in a downpour. And we did that broadcast for 5 hours. And truly remarkable, there, so many young girls talking about dominating the space of science and the science of space and getting into science. I mean, people at both marches were carrying signs like, ice has no agenda, it just melts. There is no planet B. People holding signs that said, "I'm with her," with an arrow to Mother Earth. And then there were the buttons that said, "Science, not silence." But before we covered those, we were in Denver doing a big event for independent radio, television, newspapers at the Su Teatro Performing Arts Center, a Latino community center. And the next morning before we left, we went to the Unitarian Church to see Jeanette Vizguerra. She is a Mexican immigrant, has been in this country for more than 20 years, paid taxes all of these years, has four kids. Her older daughter is DACA in her 20s. She's a dreamer. She's allowed to work and live here legally. Jeanette is one of 11 million people in this country who are undocumented. But she has been working hard. She has been a contributing member of our society. She is an immigrants' rights activist. And when Daniel Ramirez in Washington State, Washington, where we will be on Wednesday night, was arrested, also DACA, also a dreamer, legally allowed to work and live here, when he was arrested, she thought she better take sanctuary. And so she went into the Unitarian Church, which provides sanctuary. And she's been there for 2 months. We interviewed her as soon as she jumped into the church in February. She was on Skype, and we were in our TV studio in New York. Can you throw me that bag? Thank you. Can you test the cough drop before I actually eat it? No, I'm kidding. Thank you. Perfect, perfect. What would I do without you? Okay. And so we went back to visit her to see how she was doing after 2 months. Her kids were just waking up. It was Saturday morning. It was Saturday morning. We were heading to British Columbia that day. And her daughter Zuri was 6, and her son Roberto is 10. He's just a wisp of a boy. He speaks perfect English, goes to Denver Public Schools. He came out and he had a poster that his teacher had made. It was a beautiful lithograph of Jeanette. She has these extraordinary Mayan features, and it was her face, and it said, "Keep families together." And Roberto came out with the poster. He and Zuri were going to march that morning in a Cesar Chavez march. And when he came out, I was interviewing his mother, and then I started speaking to him, and he put his arm around his mother as he spoke. And he said, "We're going to march, but my mother can't. She has to stay in the church because we're afraid she's going to be arrested. So I am my mother's voice." And we did that interview, went back to New York, and we broadcast it. And in the next few days, Time magazine announced their 100 most important people in the world. Jeanette Vizguerra was among them. So then Time had this big gala, you know, in New York, and people like John Legend were there. You might have heard his choice words for Donald Trump. But all the glitterati were there. Of course, Jeanette couldn't go because she would be iced if she went outside. She could be arrested. So the community said, "Okay, we're going to throw a Time gala for you inside the church." And that was 2 Tuesdays ago, and they had a big party for Jeanette. And I really can't go in there. But the next morning, some felt it was in retaliation, Arturo Hernandez Garcia was arrested on the streets of Denver. He was going to work with his brother-in-law, as he's done for more than a decade. He had taken refuge in the church 2 years ago, in 2015, under Obama. President Obama, who even his supporters came to refer to him as the deporter-in-chief, deported millions of immigrants, more than any president in the history of the United States. And in 2015, Arturo was afraid, and so he took sanctuary at that church. And then the Department of Homeland Security gave him a letter. And the letter said he was not a priority for deportation. And he felt in good faith he should leave the church. so that he could send a message to others of the 11 million people undocumented that you don't have to be afraid, that you can come out of the shadows. And he's been working in Denver ever since. His wife and his family is in Denver. But clearly they were tracking him, knew where he would be, and when he went to his tile business that morning, he was taken. The American Friends Service Committee is working with both Jeanette and with Arturo, and Jennifer Piper of AFSC called ICE that morning and said, "What are you doing? Why did you arrest Arturo? He has a letter from DHS, from the Department of Homeland Security, that says he's not a priority. Why did you arrest him?" And they said, "This is a new administration. We have no priorities," which was an interesting way to put it. Then we were in Burlington just a few days ago, David's great state of Vermont, and a big thank you to my brother David and also to my colleague Dennis Moynihan. We co-wrote the book, Democracy Now! Together. And again, I hope you come up afterwards. If you'd like to get a copy of the book, that's fantastic. If you want to get two copies of the book, we are offering you a free DVD of the interview that Juan Gonzalez and I did with Noam Chomsky a few weeks ago in our studios. We ran it over 2 days, but we put it all together here. It's a wonderful DVD. Why get two copies? Well, Mother's Day is coming up. Father's Day will be soon. There's graduations. There's libraries. Yes, we are trying to drive this up the New York Times bestseller list or just get it onto it. Now, we don't know if it's possible. But, you know, they don't like to talk about Democracy Now! Very much in the New York Times. And so, you know, we thought we'd be brazen. We actually call the book Democracy Now! And if it gets on the Times bestseller list, as it did in the hardcover, they have to. It's just a mathematical equation. They have to print the words together. And why is it important? Well, it gets into libraries then. It gets into colleges and universities. And there are a lot of bookstores that are not like the wonderful Women and Children First. There are a lot of bookstores in this country, sadly, that only stock the bestsellers. But very good people go into them. They don't know what kind of bookstore it is. And we want to provide a kind of roadmap from those places to all the other different centers of thought, like Women and Children, like community radio, like WZRD. And when people open this book in a place like that, it's why Dennis and I write a column every week for Hearst, for King Features, that appears in newspapers around the country. I really do think that this is mainstream media. I really do think that those who are concerned about war and peace, those who are concerned about the increasing inequality in this country, those who are concerned about racial, economic, and social justice and injustice, those who care about climate change, the fate of the planet, are not a fringe minority, not even a silent majority, but the silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media, which is why we have to take the media back. So, I think I got to the four Pacifica stations, Los Angeles and Berkeley and New York and Washington. I forgot the fifth, which is in the Petro Metro in Houston, and it went on the air in 1970. We're going to go to do a fundraiser for them on May 20th. It's the only radio station in the country whose transmitter was blown up. 1970, spring, within the first few weeks of operation, the Ku Klux Klan strapped dynamite to the base of the transmitter and blew it to smithereens. They get back on their feet, they rebuild the transmitter. It was blown up right in the middle of Arlo Guthrie singing Alice's Restaurant. And I thought that was a good song. But they blow it up again. It takes months now. But then in January of 1971, it's now a national media event. Arlo Guthrie comes back into Houston to finish his song live on the air. And they've been on the air ever since. I don't remember if it was the Grand Dragon or the Exalted Cyclops, because I often confuse their titles. But he said it was his proudest act. I think that's because he understood how dangerous independent media is. dangerous because it allows people to speak for themselves. And when you hear someone speaking from their own experience, whether it's a Palestinian child or an Israeli grandmother, whether it is an aunt from the Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota, or an uncle in Afghanistan, you begin to understand where they're coming from. I didn't say agree with what you hear. How often do we even agree with our family members, right, Dave? But it makes it much less likely that you'll want to destroy them. It's that understanding that's the beginning of peace. I think the media can be the greatest force for peace on earth. Instead, all too often, it is wielded as a weapon of war, which is why we have to take it back. Now, I just told you a story about the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, it's history, decades ago. I cannot believe we're talking about the Ku Klux Klan today. I cannot believe that the person who occupies the most powerful person on the most powerful office on earth, Donald J. Trump, the president, got the endorsement of the Ku Klux Klan, David Duke, and others. And you think about how this happened. Yes, he was a leader for many years of the birther movement, that racist movement that challenged the legitimacy of Barack Obama as president of the United States. Now, President Obama can be criticized for a lot of things. He signs an executive order to close Guantanamo, doesn't do it for 8 years. He becomes the deporter in chief, millions of immigrants, expanding the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, bringing drone attacks to a whole new level. But not being born in this country, saying he was a secret Muslim. Now, I want to say something about that. It is almost impossible to address that issue. Because when you say you're saying he's a Muslim, it sounds like you're saying there's something wrong with that. Like, you allege that he's Jewish? He certainly isn't Jewish. You think he's Christian? He's not a Christian. And so it makes it difficult to deal with that. But it's just about the truth, the religion that he is. And when it comes to being the legitimate president of the United States, Donald Trump saying he had the smoking gun, that he had sent investigators to Hawaii, and he had the truth, clearly was a lie. He never showed any of what he said he had. And what it simply was dog whistle politics, appealing to the worst in people in this country, racism and xenophobia, anti-Muslim sentiment. And yet, there are so many more people who are so much better than that and understand how dangerous that is. Like Jeanette Vizguerra in the church, when she told me in the church that she'd gotten many death threats, and I said, so then what gives you hope? And she said, oh, because many, many more people express their support. And I immediately thought of the great writer Isabel Allende, who said, for every thug, for every paramilitary killer, there are thousands of compañeras and compañeros who are there to help. And that was Jeanette's attitude. And it was not only people randomly just writing to her. She said the Denver police chief spoke to her. I believe he came to the church and said, I have your back. You tell me if you're getting death threats. The mayor of Denver said he supported her. The local congressman, Jared Polis, said he supported her. You know, Juan Gonzalez, who's been with Democracy Now! From the beginning, 21 years ago, fantastic journalist in New York. And he has a new book coming out, and I hope everyone will read it, and I hope he'll be here in Chicago. We went to a meeting about a month ago in New York City, in downtown New York City, and it was a room that was packed with hundreds of people. It wasn't your typical noble activists who go out on the streets. It was local city council members from around the country, state legislators, mayors, elected officials of every stripe, who are coming together to say, how do we provide sanctuary in our cities? They are an integral part of the resistance. Don't assume because of a person's position what their actual position might be. It is amazing what is taking place today. From the day after the inauguration, now you remember the inauguration, Donald Trump had something like 180,000 people there, a perfectly respectable number. But when the pictures came out that showed that his was smaller than President Obama's from 9 years before, I mean, I think it was about 10% of President Obama's. His was 180,000, Trump's, Obama's was something like 1.8 million, but we'll put that aside for a moment. Still 180,000 people is a heck of a lot of people. He was obsessed, and he hasn't stopped. His resentment, and then simply lying. I think eventually he would say he had the largest inaugural crowd in history. That sort of obscured the fact that the next day, on January 21st, in Washington, the same period of time, within 24 hours, well over three times the number of people came out to resist him. The Women's March and the allies of women who said, and this was so powerful, there were speakers nonstop for hours. I don't think 90% of the crowd heard any of those speakers. There were so many people who were there. You know, that was like, you know, when Dr. King spoke in 1963, I Have a Dream. You know, most people did not hear him. First of all, it was the end of the whole day. And people at the back just couldn't hear, and a lot of people had left. But I thought about that when some people, we ran, and you should really tune into Democracy Now! You can check it out. We have everything online, but I think it was the January 23rd, the Monday after, that we ran, and people were saying, what march was that? Because we were playing, we were hooked into the stage, and it was an amazing experience there, too. Among the people who spoke was, well, she was 6 years old when she went up to the Pope. You remember Sophie? And he was in the United States, and she said, do not deport my parents, please. She broke through the police crowd. That's a pretty good start at the age of six. And so you had this protest, the Women's March. And then you had the response to Muslim Ban 1 and Muslim Ban 2. I mean, this extraordinary, spontaneous uprising all over the country. And by the way, the Women's March, that wasn't one of the biggest marches. In Los Angeles, they had 750,000 people who came out. But the Muslim ban, the lawyer who argued on behalf of the ACLU in Brooklyn, he came out of the courthouse that Saturday. I think it was issued on Friday, the Muslim ban won through an executive order. He walked out of the courthouse. There were 1,000 people there to encourage him. He said, how did this happen? And then the people who flocked to JFK, to Dulles, to LAX. Did it happen at Chicago Airport? Okay, I'm sure you were all there. In Dulles, a senator and a judge were manhandled by security. But the outpouring of people saying, we are much better than this. And then the president's executive order, the is stayed by a Washington state judge who Donald Trump called a so-called judge. I mean, Trump is is used to being the CEO of a real estate empire, and the janitor does not tell him no. And that's exactly what he clearly felt when this guy says no. We are engaged in a nationwide civics lesson right now. It is astounding. From fifth grade to kindergarten to adults, learning about the three co-equal branches of government that protects a democracy, legislative, executive, judiciary. I mean, the fact that just a week ago, the Attorney General of the United States, Jeff Sessions, said on a right-wing radio talk show, and this was in response to Muslim ban 2, right? Muslim ban 1 says no to refugees from 7 Muslim-majority countries. Muslim ban 2, they drop it down to 6, no to 6 Muslim-majority countries. No refugees can come here. And Muslim ban 2 was stopped by a judge in Hawaii. And Attorney General Sessions said, how is it possible that a man on an island in the Pacific can say no to the President of the United States? I think the only group that probably got, you know, felt good about this statement was the sovereignty movement in Hawaii that asked the very same thing and says, we don't want to be a part of you. But it is truly amazing what's happening. And then you have tax day and the number of people coming out demanding that President Trump reveal his tax returns. Jeanette Vizgara, by the way, when she became one of the most important people in the world, according to Time magazine, she held a news conference, couldn't go outside, was inside the church, and she held up her 2016 tax returns. And she said, President Trump, I'm sharing mine, now you share yours. But it really matters, because you cannot have faith that what is being done in foreign policy and in domestic policy, you can't know, is this being done to further someone's financial interests, or is it being done because there's some kind of logic in terms of foreign or domestic policy, like the bombing of Syria. Now, the U.S., make no mistake about it, before it bombed the Syrian government airport, which the Syrian military just simply used the next day and from there on, bombed it, attacked it with 59 Tomahawk cruise missiles. President Trump, at least the last documents we have, show that he had investments in Raytheon, which makes these Tomahawk cruise missiles. He's doing it to make money? I don't know. Reveal your tax returns and we can make sense of this. You also have, and I want to talk about when it comes to war, what happens and what's happening with the media today. We have something very unusual happening. And that is, President Trump has chosen to attack the media. He's been doing it for years, but it's very unusual for a president of the United States to go after with such ferocity, with such regularity, with such venom and hatred, to attack the media, which is essential to the functioning of a democratic society. I almost don't want to say this out loud, but it seems to me if he stopped for just a few days, that the media would do what it always does, wrap itself around the establishment. But he is obsessed with calling us the enemy of the American people, calling the media the enemy of the people, you know, talking about the failing New York Times and attacking reporters continuously by name and networks. And so the media, it has forced the media, the corporate media, to stand up in a way we have not seen before. Talking about how important it is to have a fourth estate. You know, David and I wrote a couple of books together. The first one is called Exception to the Rulers. That's what all the media should be, the exception to the rulers. The second is called Static. And the reason we call it that... The reason, we can take a picture afterwards. You're making me nervous. The reason we call it that is because in this high-tech digital age with digital radio and high-definition television, still all we get is static. That veil of distortion and lies and misrepresentations and half-truths that obscure reality. When what we need the media to give us is the dictionary definition of static, criticism. Opposition, unwanted interference. We need a media that covers power, not covers for power. We need a media that is the fourth estate, not for the state. And we need a media that covers the movements that create static and make history. Now, I don't know if the media would go so far as saying all those things, but they're coming close right now. And it's very important, except when it comes to war. You see, that is the time when the media circles the wagons around the White House, whether it's a Democratic or Republican administration. And so when the U.S. bombed the Syrian airfield, and remember, the U.S. is involved in the bombing of Syria before and after, killing scores, hundreds, how many civilians we don't know in Syria, not to mention in other places, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Yemen, in Somalia. When the president does this, the media pulls back from that criticism. In Syria, he's now today become president. In Afghanistan, when President Trump dropped the largest non-nuclear bomb ever dropped in the world on Afghanistan, it's called the Moab. The Pentagon's nicknamed it the mother of all bombs, the massive ordnance air blast, that its radius of blast is 1 mile. It was developed under President Bush. He didn't dare to use it. President Obama didn't use it. And Donald Trump, within his first few months in office, drops this bomb. You have the attack in Yemen. Was it 8-10 days after he became president, killed a Navy SEAL, and many women and children in Yemen? When this Navy SEAL's body was sent back to Dover, of course, his family was there, and President Trump went, and the father of the Navy SEAL refused to meet with or shake the hand of the president, saying, "Why did he engage in this attack? Why did he do this, this attack that killed my son?" When the U.S. engages in this, and then you have the kind of State of the Union, his joint address to Congress, that is addressed to a joint session of Congress, where the widow of the Navy SEAL was there. He pointed her out. It was so utterly painful to see her in her tears, in her misery, in her deep, deep sorrow. And that was the other time, these three major moments, when even the oppositional media, the critical media, said that is when President Trump became president. It is precisely in times of war that we need the media to be independent, to ask the questions. We need a media, when we cover war, that is not brought to us by the weapons manufacturers. When we cover... when we cover healthcare that's not brought to us by the insurance industry and big pharma. Have you ever watched TV for more than half an hour before every single drug is touted every 5 or 6 minutes, not to mention the Sunday talk shows brought to you by Raytheon and Boeing and McDonnell Douglas? And we need a media, when we cover climate change, that's not brought to you by the oil, the gas, the coal, the nuclear companies. You know, when Juan retired from the New York Daily News after being a columnist for 29 years last year, I think we were on the book tour. I don't know if I was in Chicago during one of his extremely numerous retirement parties. Everyone was throwing him a party. It's amazing. I mean, the power of Juan, and you should read all of his books and watch him on Democracy Now!, and now he's a professor at Rutgers. One of those parties was at the Francis Tavern, and it was thrown by the Daily News, and I don't know, maybe 125 people packed in. It's not such a big place. And I was getting texts on the road while I was speaking that, you know, Mayor de Blasio just left, Governor Cuomo just came in. And they wouldn't be seen together because they hate each other, but they both were there to say farewell to one. And at first I was saying, you know, Senator Schumer, the New York senator, saying, Juan, wait a second, what is going on? You know, like, we're not supposed to be a party to the parties. Why are all these elected officials celebrating Juan? I came to the conclusion that they wanted to come to these farewell parties to ensure with their own eyes that this guy that has, who has dogged them for so long is in fact leaving. But he's actually not, because he stays with us at Democracy Now! And we continue to hold those in power accountable. But last year, Juan was also inducted into the New York Journalism Hall of Fame, the first Latino journalist to be inducted. And we all went to the ceremony. It was in Midtown Manhattan. And he was inducted with Charlie Rose and Leslie Stahl and Max Frankel of the New York Times. But his speech put them all to shame. He said, I figured my modest contribution would be not writing about outcast neighborhoods, but from them. Not simply to entertain, but to change. Not after the fact, but before it, when coverage could still make a difference. He said, I've tried to use as many of my columns as possible to probe the injustices visited upon the powerless. Yes, the rich and famous are also victims on occasion. But they have so many politicians, lobbyists, lawyers, gossip columnists, and even editorial writers ready to jump to their defense that they'll always do fine without my help. Juan said, I prefer the desperate unknown reader who comes to me because he or she has gone everywhere else and no one will listen. More often than not, I come across unexpected gems, human beings whose tragedies illuminate the landscape, and whose courage hopefully inspires the reader to believe that there is indeed some greater good served by a free press than just chronicling or influencing the ouster of one group of politicians by another. And I think that very much embodies and encapsulates our beliefs and our mission at Democracy Now!, which is why I want to talk about the Dakota Access Pipeline and the remarkable standoff at Standing Rock. It started on April 1st, this past year, in North Dakota. The unofficial historian of the Standing Rock Sioux, LaDonna Brave Bull Allard, said she would open her property to those who were resisting the Dakota Access Pipeline. Her land abuts the Cannonball River, this beautiful, magnificent space. And soon scores of people were coming, natives and non-natives alike. And there were so many people, because soon hundreds and then thousands, that they hoped to open up more resistance camps, like the Red Warrior Camp. I mean, this was the largest unification of Native American tribes that this country has seen in decades, from Latin America, from the United States, the First Nations, from Canada, all gathering in North Dakota. They were challenging, they were resisting the $3.8 billion Dakota Access Pipeline that would snake its way from the Bakken oil fields of North Dakota, taking fracked oil from North Dakota. The Native Americans call it the Black Snake. Would take that from North Dakota through South Dakota, through Iowa, Illinois, and then hook up with a pipeline to the Gulf of Mexico. And the Native Americans said no, said that they were afraid with it going under the Missouri River, that it could pollute the water of 17 million people downstream, the Missouri, the longest river in North America. They were not only talking about themselves or their reservation, they were talking about everyone, because it was not even only the people that relied on the Missouri River. They're talking about challenging the fossil fuel economy, demanding we turn to renewables, making this planet more sustainable. You know, it's interesting, at the marches, one woman came up to me and said, people are saying, will this planet survive? She said, of course the planet's going to survive. It's us that won't. But the Native Americans are trying to turn this around, and they see themselves not as protesters, but as water protectors. And this is all going on during the election in 2016. Now, if you remember, in the general election, I don't
call these people journalists exactly. I call them media personalities. And they're moderating these debates. Did one of them ask a presidential candidate about climate change, about the fate of the planet? And here was this historic, epic gathering. And so we went to North Dakota. I went with our producer, Laura Gottesdiener, and our videographer, John Hamilton, and my colleague, Dennis Moynihan. And we went to North Dakota Labor Day weekend. You know, even that was late. You know, the people had been standing up since April 1st. We were covering it before, but we weren't there on the ground. Now we wanted to see with our own eyes. And we went there, and it was just remarkable what we found. I mean, these protests that went along back prairie roads, led by native elders carrying glasses of water, children, women, men, and they would walk along the roads and they would be met by a fully militarized sheriff's department. I mean, they have MRAPs, they have tanks, drones, you know about Ferguson. You know what happened in Ferguson with the killing of Michael Brown, 18-year-old teenager who would have gone on to college. Did you hear, it was just today, that in Florida University said that they would award posthumously a college degree to Trayvon Martin. But Michael Brown was headed off to college, and instead, he died in a hail of police bullets in August. And we know about the uprising that took place, and the whole world saw this militarized police department. Well, it's similar to what's happened in North Dakota. I mean, this is recycling in America today. They take the weapons and hardware from Afghanistan and Iraq, and they give it to the police departments of this country. You know, we had Norm Stamper in our studio a few weeks ago, the former police chief of Seattle. And Chief Stamper was the chief in charge of the police during the Battle of Seattle in 1999, when tens of thousands of people marched against the World Trade Organization, the supranational organization that can overturn the laws of democratically elected legislatures. Let's say you'd want GMO labeling, genetically modified organism labeling. You're not even saying no, you're just saying I want to know if I'm eating it. And let's say your city council passes that. The World Trade Organization can say that's WTO illegal. You're presenting a barrier to trade. They can fine a city, a state, a country. And, you know, kids learn their civics lessons in high school. So you had high schoolers out. You had teachers out. You had farmers, doctors, nurses out. You had environmentalists and you had Teamsters. You had a whole array of society. And they were met by the full military force of the state. I mean, when I say we were reporters covering it, but there's no distinction when there's tear gas in the air. Stamper used so much tear gas that they had to go to other states to get more gas. And rubber-coated bullets. Seattle had never seen anything like this before. Ultimately, after the hundreds, I think well over 600 arrests, and a city in turmoil, very much, I would say, from a police riot, Stamper was forced out, as he should have been. He was just in our studio saying this was the worst mistake of his life. He said, this is what happens when you have a militarized police department. You see your children, your neighbors, the teachers, the nurses as the enemy. Which is why he is calling for police reform all over this country. Never assume, from whatever position a person is in, how they will respond and what they really think.
which makes me think of Arkansas, what happened in the past weeks. I mean, this mass killing that took place. The state wanted to kill 8 men on death row by the end of April. They only succeeded in killing 4, and they managed to get in a doubleheader at that. Doubleheader, you think it's about, you know, baseball? No, it is horrifyingly a new name for killing 2 men in one night, something that hasn't happened in 17 years in this country. And they wanted 3 of these doubleheaders. Why were they rushing to kill these men on death row, who had been on death row for many, many years? Because their supply of midazolam, this wasn't a justice issue, it was a drug supply, part of the execution cocktail, was going to expire. When I first heard this, you know, I'm thinking, drugs expire, what is the problem with this? That they'll kill you? Or maybe it's that they don't work. But, and what difference does it make if the drugs are expiring? By their logic, you just buy more. Well, not if you can't get them anymore. And that's an amazing story of resistance. The European Union forbid European drug companies from providing drugs to the United States if they're going to be used to execute people. And that goes back to World War II. Yes, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer, Adolf Hitler did gas people. Yes, did use chemical warfare against millions of Jews and others. You know that he denied this in a White House press briefing. And so the European companies, some who go back to World War II and have a very unsavory involvement in the killing of Jews, they don't want to be associated with this anymore. And that is spread to US companies. So there was this company, McKesson, that sued the state of Arkansas, saying you misrepresented what you were going to use. It's a drug called vercuronium bromide. You didn't tell us you were going to use it to execute people. So they sued the state, and a judge ruled in their favor. And this judge, Wendell Griffin, African-American judge, then went out on Good Friday, just a few weeks ago, to the governor's mansion in Little Rock and laid down in front of it on a cot to protest the death penalty. He had all capital cases taken from them then. This is a man of conscience. And we are seeing this increasingly all over this country, and we need a media that chronicles these movements. And so back to North Dakota, back to the remarkable protest movement and the people marching and providing water to the best described as the RoboCop uniformed cops that you don't even know if you can see their faces. And they're providing them with water and saying, this is for you as well as for us. This is for your children. We're trying to protect this as well as our own. And then they are arrested, dozens, now hundreds of Native Americans and their allies. So we were documenting all this, and on September 3rd, it was Saturday. A few days before, a judge asked the tribe, because he was going to weigh in on this case the next week, to prove to him that Dakota Access Pipeline was violating sacred ground, was digging up sacred ground. He said, you show me where your burial mounds are. So the tribe did that. They complied, and they gave him a map. He gave the map to Energy Transfer Partners, which owns the Dakota Access Pipeline. And on this Saturday, when we were there, we followed a group of Native Americans who went to this very area to plant their Native flags. They didn't expect that DAPL was going to be excavating then. It was a holiday weekend. And then they saw the bulldozers at full tilt, excavating the very area they had designated. Now, they believe that
It was the map they provided that the bulldozers before this were way down the road, that they leapfrogged over to this area, so that when the judge ruled the next week, no matter what he ruled, they would have changed the facts on the ground. It would have been a moot point. And they were horrified when they saw this. And first it was a mother and her child, and then many other people following. This was led by women. They came up on the property, and they were demanding that the bulldozer stop. I mean, the brave individual acts I can't describe. It is terrifying. These bulldozers are massive machines that are churning up the earth. And to stand there, I could only think, as we were filming, back to March 16th, 2003, 3 days before the U.S. invaded Iraq, in a different area of the Middle East, in Gaza, in Rafah. An Evergreen College student from Washington State named Rachel Corey went as part of the International Solidarity Movement to bear witness, to show solidarity with Palestinians and try to be part of a citizen's response to what was happening in the Middle East and somehow bring peace to the Israelis and Palestinians. And she was standing in front of a pharmacist's home who she had befriended, the whole family. And she donned this orange fluorescent, you know, vest like construction workers wear, along with other activists. And they lined up in front of the bulldozers to try to stop this Israeli military bulldozer from destroying her friend's house. Israeli military bulldozer made in the United States by Caterpillar. And she was crushed to death. And that's what I thought about when I saw these women, children, men, boys, girls, standing in front of these bulldozers. But this time they succeeded. They won. And the bulldozer started to pull back. One, two, three, four, five, six, drawing back as more and more people came forward, coming from the resistance camps. Now hundreds of people heard down the road what was happening, and they came as reinforcements to ensure that their sacred land was protected. And it was just amazing seeing the stream of humanity to see. And that's when the Dakota Access Pipeline guards unleashed attack dogs on the Native Americans. We just kept filming. Even the dogs pulled back, and they would throw them into the crowd, and they would bite their way out. And we filmed a dog with its mouth and nose dripping with blood. And we filmed people who were bitten. And we posted this on Facebook that night. And within 24, 48 hours, there were 14 million views. Now, this is just to say, when the corporate media says people aren't interested in these issues, oh, I beg to differ. 14 million views in a very brief period of time. These are the critical issues of the day, and people are hungry to see the images, to understand what happens in their name. We left North Dakota then. Oh, we interviewed, among many others, Winona LaDuke from the White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota. She had pitched a teepee with others at the Red Warrior Camp. And she said, about the North Dakota governor, she said, Governor Dalrymple, that's his name, Jack Dalrymple, she said, Governor Dalrymple, you are not George Wallace. This is not Alabama. This is not 1965. We are through. So we went back to New York. We continued broadcasting Democracy Now! We showed that video and got response from all different people. You know, the video and the evidence of what happened led the North Dakota Inspection Board to investigate the use of dogs. They said it was illegal, but they were unlicensed dogs brought in from Ohio. That week, President Obama was making an historic trip to Laos. You remember his Asia trip. And at the end of that trip, he held a democracy forum for young Asian students. And they came from all over Asia. And at the end of that forum, a young woman from Malaysia raised her hand. And she said, President Obama, what about the Dakota Access Pipeline?
No American journalist had asked President Obama publicly about this. And it took a young Malaysian student who was there to learn a lesson in democracy from President Obama to ask this question. And Obama held forth eloquently about the oppression of Native Americans for centuries in this country. And then he actually addressed the issue by saying something like, I have to get back to my team on that. He did come back to the United States that week. This is before the judge would be ruling on Friday. And reportedly, he saw the video of the dogs. Now, this wasn't lost on the first African-American president of our country, what this meant. On Friday, well, Thursday night, Governor Dalrymple called out the National Guard. It did not look good for the Native Americans. The authorities quietly issued an arrest warrant for me. Now, I actually did not know this on Thursday. On Friday, the judge ruled at 5 o'clock, right thereabouts, and ruled against the tribe. That means Obama's Justice Department had prevailed over the tribe. It was a terrible decision. And the Justice Department lawyers were probably about to pop their champagne corks when, like 15 minutes later, an unprecedented three-agency letter from the Department of Interior, the Army Corps of Engineers, and the Justice Department that had just prevailed. This letter was issued saying they were going to slow this whole process down. They weren't going to immediately move forward. I mean, this was whiplash for the tribe. First, they get the worst decision ever, and 15 minutes later, they hear, oh, now they're going to stop. Clearly, it was orchestrated by the White House. This was a very big deal. Anyway, that day, we went to Canada. We weren't fleeing, but we did the show, and Democracy Now!'s Nermeen Sheikh and I flew to Toronto because the Toronto International Film Festival was premiering the film about the muckraking journalist I.F. Stone, who said to young people, if you're going to remember two words, remember governments lie. If you can remember three words, remember all governments lie. And so we were going to speak after, also with Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone. We all went up. And I decided to go up because I thought, you know, in Canada, people really care about First Nations. And it's really important to talk about what we had just seen a few days before in North Dakota. So we spoke that night after the film, and the next day we were invited to the University of Toronto. And there was a crowd about this size, and we were each giving a speech, and I was giving my speech, and then in the middle of the speech, I get a text, and it says, you're under arrest. So, I mean, it said something like, there's an arrest warrant out for you. And so I was a little bit confused. I thought, oh, this must be some kind of scam or spam or something. But I did notice, and I'm still speaking just like I'm doing now, and I'm trying to continue with whatever I was talking about. And I am thinking, wow, okay, if this is true, and I did notice it was a North Dakota number, I'm in trouble because I'm in Canada. And you don't necessarily get picked right up if you have an arrest warrant, but if you are dealing with police or the FBI or border guards, and they see an arrest warrant in the system, that's when they snatch you. And I had to go over the border. So I didn't think it was a good idea to reveal this at the moment. I thought I'd better get back into the United States before this arrest warrant, whenever it was issued, would get into the system. And so I just said, could someone call a cab? And I didn't even say I was going to the airport. But I got in that cab and I went to the airport. And I did make it over the border safely to the United States. And I came home and thought, can they just keep you from your country? Well, we know that in other places that is possible. But so I came home to New York. I didn't take the arrest warrant personally. I really thought it was a message to all journalists, do not come to North Dakota, which is exactly why we had to go there. I was particularly disturbed that young journalists would be afraid to go, thinking
If they want to go because they care about these epic struggles, and they care about the issue of climate change, and they care about the fate of the planet and their future, if they felt if they go and they're arrested, they can't afford this, they don't have the resources, they don't have an institution behind them. And I wanted to say, you do not have to get a record when you put things on the record. We were going to call the bluff of the state authorities of North Dakota. And so a few weeks later, we went back. The same team, we flew back. It was a Friday afternoon in October to answer these charges. And as we flew into Bismarck, the prosecutor announced he was dropping the charges. But then he announced he would bring more serious charges against me. Riot. Well, I'm a one-woman riot? And I could face a year in prison. Now, this was unacceptable, to put it mildly. And I asked my North Dakota lawyer, not that I had had one before, what does this mean? What's going to happen? And he said, well, you'll be arraigned at 1:30 on Monday afternoon. I said, oh, okay, so it's Friday afternoon, 1:30 on Monday. Oh, we can cover the protests all weekend, which is what we did. But also, I said, now how does this work? It's just automatic. I just go into the court. Nothing happens between now and then when it comes to the legal system. He said, well, I mean, the judge will sign off on the charges and then you're arraigned. Then wait a second, that's a human being. A judge has discretion in this at this point? He said, well, it's absolutely pro forma. 100% of the time they sign off on these charges. That's not the issue. He said, you have to deal with the arraignment. Then they use their discretion in the trial and all of that. He said, no. What's the name of the judge? So we issued a press release that said this judge would be deciding whether or not I would be arraigned at 1:30. We covered the protests over the weekend. And on Monday morning, the show must go on. And so we got a satellite van truck from Minneapolis, and we broadcast in front of the Mandan courthouse and jail so that afterwards I could turn myself in. We broadcast right across from the jail and the courthouse. The only thing in between them is the Ten Commandments. And we broadcast from the church property across the street. And I interviewed the chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, Dave Archambault, the 45th chairman, like the 45th president of the United States. And I asked him if he had ever been arrested. And he said yes, this was on the air, that he had been arrested once. It was during the civil disobedience in this period. He's charged with a low-level misdemeanor for civil disobedience. And he was strip-searched. He was put in an orange jumpsuit, and he was jailed. He interviewed Dr. Sarah Jumping Eagle, the pediatrician of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. She was one of the first to be arrested in the summer because she cared about the health of the children. And we know about Flint, Michigan, and the poisoning of an American city there through its water supply. And, that's what she was concerned about when it came to the Dakota Access Pipeline going under the Missouri River. So she was arrested, charged with a low-level misdemeanor, civil disobedience. She was strip-searched, she was put in an orange jumpsuit, and she was jailed. I mean, the humiliation upon humiliation. Once at the airport in Bismarck, North Dakota, I was reading a magazine before getting on a flight, and a guy came over and he said, I know who you are. And I said, oh, well, who are you? And he said, I was one of the guards on the site that day. I saw the video you guys put out. And he said, I wasn't with the security firm that unleashed the dogs. We didn't know that was happening. He said, Dakota Access Pipeline, owned by Energy Transfer Partners, had several different security firms there. And we were as shocked as anyone when we saw these dogs brought out. He said, you don't think we get it? I mean, we sick dogs on them after massacres of hundreds of years. You don't think we understand why they're mad? Again, never assume whatever position a person occupies in life, how they actually feel. So we interviewed Winona LaDuke that day as well. And at the end of the broadcast, more and more hundreds of Native Americans came to show their support, to have ceremonies there. before the 1:30 arraignment. And we got word from North Dakota Public Radio right before I was going into the arraignment that the judge had decided not to move forward with the charges. The judge, the prosecutor, wanted to. That the judge had exercised his discretion. And I think that came about because of the enormous attention this was getting because a journalist was being arrested. I mean, you had the New York Times, you had the Washington Post, you had the Los Angeles Times, you had the homepage of the BBC, you had Al Jazeera, I mean, Vogue magazine. I've got to spiff up my act here. And this is what it takes when the media spotlight shines in the right direction. And it wasn't only me. The Native Americans who were facing felony and misdemeanor charges that day, a number of them had their charges dismissed. This is what it means when the media pays attention. I am all for... I'm all for reality TV when it really expresses the reality on the ground. So we left that day, and as we flew out, for some reason, the sheriff in town, the prosecutor said, somehow they would get me as we were flying out. I mean, talking about harassment and intimidation, it is truly unacceptable. But most importantly, you know, hundreds of people, over 600 people have been arrested. The resistance continued. And then December 5th, another three agency letter was released. And the Obama administration basically said they weren't going to move forward with the Dakota Access Pipeline, that they would either reroute or they would figure out another way, perhaps not move forward at all. And Energy Transfer Partners, which owns the pipeline, was going to sue. But that's where it stood until Donald Trump was inaugurated president and one of his first acts in office issued an executive order saying the Keystone XL would be revived, that was killed years ago, and he would grant the permit for the final building of the pipeline under the Missouri River. And that's what has happened to this date. Though at the People's Climate March, a number of Native Americans from Standing Rock Sioux Reservation and others said that no oil has yet to flow through that pipeline. And they've launched an international divestment campaign against the financial institutions like Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and others that are supporting the pipeline. But what they face in Washington is an oligarchy. I mean, you have the Secretary of State is Rex Tillerson, the former CEO of the largest oil corporation, private corporation in the world, ExxonMobil, that obscured the reality of climate change. They did some of the best research on climate change in the 70s and the 80s. And then they hid this research. And so at the People's Climate March, I interviewed Maura Healey, who's the Attorney General of Massachusetts, together with Eric Schneiderman, Attorney General of New York, and other attorneys general. They are suing ExxonMobil for obscuring this. I interviewed a 12-year-old girl named Hazel, who together with other under 21-year-olds sued President Obama, are now suing President Trump for stealing their future. So you've got Rex Tillerson, former CEO of ExxonMobil, a Secretary of State. You've got Scott Pruitt, the former Attorney General of Oklahoma, who hardly ever knew earthquakes, now is a land of quakes from fracking, sued the EPA 14 times, has wanted to eviscerate this agency. Now he's in charge of it. And you've got Governor Perry, Governor Rick Perry of Texas, who ran for president twice, bankrolled to the tune of $6 million by Kelsey Warren, the CEO of Energy Transfer Partners, which owns the Dakota Access Pipeline. When Governor Perry stepped down as governor, he immediately went on the board of Energy Transfer Partners, only stepped down to become Secretary of Energy. These are powerful positions, but there is a force more powerful. And it is everyone, everywhere, deeply concerned about what's happening. and understanding that you do not achieve democracy ever. You have to fight for it every single day. And I wanted to just end on one last story, and then David and I are going to sit down, and whether or not you get a book, feel free to line up and say hello. If you have stories or people you think we should interview on Democracy Now!, we get so many of our ideas from you in places like this all over the country and the world. You can send your ideas to stories@democracynow.org anytime you feel something should be covered. Or you can, you know, find us on Facebook. You can, if you are sending out any pictures or any thoughts today in any kind of social media, you could please use the hashtag covering the movements. And, you know, I talked about the buttons that people wore at the marches. That's science, not silence. And I want to end back in World War II, right after which Pacifica was formed. Back in World War II in Germany, with a sister and brother named Hans and Sophie Scholl, together with their professor and other students and workers, they formed the White Rose Collective. And they thought, what can we do in the face of the Nazi atrocity? Hans and Sophie weren't Jewish, they were German Christians. And they decided to put out a series of pamphlets so that the Germans would never be able to say, we didn't know. And so they put out six pamphlets. On one of them it said, we will not be silent. They made many, many copies of these, and they would distribute them under cover of darkness in alleyways and schoolyards and marketplaces. Eventually, Hans and Sophie and their professor were captured. They were charged, they were tried, they were convicted, and they were beheaded. But that philosophy, that motto, should be the Hippocratic Oath of the media today, should be the Hippocratic Oath of us all today. We will not be silent. Democracy Now!